listening to People United, the show in solidarity with the people of the world. I'm Alan Campbell. This week, People United features Maria Milner on diversity, outreach, and internal work, particularly as they pertain to relations between Unitarian Universalist congregations and people of color. On April 17th, 1960, as a guest on NBC's Meet the Press, Martin Luther King Jr. said, "It is one of the tragedies of our nation, one of the shameful tragedies, that 11 o'clock on Sunday morning is one of the most segregated hours, if not the most segregated hour, in Christian America." Of course, this lament can also apply to congregations that are not necessarily Christian. And while some seek to remedy the situation, the prescription may seem elusive. Maria Milner is a Latinx cultural consultant, a co-founder of the social action group Voces Tejas, and a member of the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin. She spoke at her church on this difficult subject on April 15, 2018, just 2 days before the 58th anniversary of King's aforementioned remark. We go now to Maria Milner. You're listening to People United on KOOP, Co-op Radio, Austin.
I want to start off by saying that this is going to be a difficult conversation. This forum will challenge the majority of the congregation that identifies as white and enjoys the privileges of being white or white passing. In my work in the world, I am often asked by well-meaning allies, always white, why, quote, "my people," end quote, don't go out to vote. How is this possible, exclaim such allies, when there are so many issues that affect them? Don't they know they need to participate? Don't they know that there are people out there that share their values? So before I continue, I want to say a little bit about why I am here at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin and why I'm a member of this congregation. I came to First UU because of the end goals, the mission, and the principles of UUism. They resonated with me in ways that had long been gone from my spiritual connectivity with the world. I hadn't been part of a congregation in a very long while, and I was at a point in my life that I was looking for a place to call a spiritual home when I found First UU. I'd like for you all to keep that in mind as we continue this conversation, because like I said, these are going to be difficult topics. I identify as a person of the global majority, and there are reasons that I did come to stay at First UU and why I am trying to work through a lot of the issues that I'll be talking about today. So it never fails that the question of whether or not my people share values with a certain voting bloc always makes me upset, and it does so for a host of reasons. Quote, "my people," end quote, is insulting both to the people who you think should or would identify as me and to me. Because my work focuses on supporting Latinx communities, I often ask, what do you mean by, quote, "my people," end quote? Almost always I'm told, well, Latinx, of course, or, you know, no, I don't. I don't know what or who you think my people are. Please describe that to me with a luxury of detail. Those questions also presume that Latinx people are not restricted in some way, shape, form, or fashion to voting as the person is asking. The question of why don't they go is based on the lived experience and privilege of the person asking, and not the people they are asking the question about. The questions of, quote, "don't they know," end quote, ascribes that Latinx people do not pay attention to the world around them because the effect is that they are not politically engaged in ways that conform to the dominant culture. The question that Latinx people's participation is appalling given that they, quote, "share values," end quote, assumes that Latinx perspective is aligned with the dominant culture and their perspective. All of it drips with colorblindness, classism, and a savior complex. All of those things that I've experienced, I've also had as an experience as a participant here at the Unitarian Universalist Church. What I'm about to discuss is largely based on my own experiences as a UU. Most of these things have been directed at me, some observed by me. The microaggressive ways I've been approached and have seen that I'll have in this presentation have been both in direct and in coded language. The macroaggressions that I'll describe are issues I've seen firsthand and heard firsthand. If we're going to speak the language of building the beloved community, we must also recognize that there is a reckoning of accountability work to do, and it will not be easy. Let's begin by discussing aggressions and how they will relate to our later talk on accountability. First, let's identify the two types of aggressions I'll be discussing. Those are microaggressions and macroaggressions. Microaggressions are statements, actions, or incidents regarded as an instance of indirect, subtle, or unintentional discrimination against members of a marginalized group. They are the, quote, little things that add up, end quote. They are the actions, constant and small, that whittle away at the will and the desire of a person of the global majority or a person of diverse background to be a part of any space. Before I continue, I want to take this moment to define the term person of the global majority. The term was first introduced to me by Fatima Mann, executive director of Counterbalance ATX, and it means a Black, Indigenous, or a person of color. Those three identifiers make up the majority of the world's population, hence the term people of the global majority. I'm using the term people of diverse backgrounds to include the other ways in which a person's lived experience dictates their daily lives. This includes the LGBTQIA+ community, the disabled community, the impoverished community, the formerly incarcerated. The list goes on. And it's not limited to people of the global majority. So back to microaggressions. The first of the common microaggressions I've experienced has been tied to language. So it's, quote, you speak so well, end quote. And it has a history of oppression rooted in the expectation of people of the global majority to be undereducated. To quote the character of Gloria Pritchett from Modern Family, do you know how smart I am in Spanish? To make those kind of statements like, you speak so well, or you do that so well for someone who, is to diminish a person's intelligence. Furthermore, it's racist and or ableist, depending on who you're talking to and what you're saying. For the moments those words are used to applaud someone's ability to do something, presumes at first that they would have had the inability to do said thing. Disability does not equate to inability. That statement is also discriminatory, and above all, it's presumptive. The second microaggression is objectification and othering. Back in February, I attended the Southwestern Women's UU conference in town. I dressed myself in one of my favorite traditional embroidered Mexican dresses and wore my flower crown. I arrived ready to engage in the conference with the pride of the full display of my culture. And after meeting the only other woman of the global majority of three that were in attendance that day, we sat down for lunch. The fellow women of the global majority and I started talking about the lack of understanding among the UU church. And I'd made the joke that at least neither of us had been unwantedly touched so far. As if by conjuring, not more than 1 minute later, an older white lady at the conference came up from behind me and touched my flower crown. No warning, no notice, and definitely no permission. I looked up and she smiled at me, said nothing, and proceeded to sit down next to me to eat. The entire span of lunch, and not once did she introduce herself, talk to me, or attempt to explain her action. To this moment, I have continued to feel like I was there for her curiosity's consumption, and that is a terrible feeling to leave someone you claim you want to build community with. Unwanted touching of anyone is harassment. It displays disrespect of one's bodily autonomy, and it diminishes a person to their features. Recently, I've also experienced the visible frustration of the rejection of one's help in matters where cultural competency and representation matter. After speaking last Sunday during the monthly service offering for Counterbalance ATX, I was approached by a congregant who offered her services to volunteer with Counterbalance as a resume reviewer. The offer was direct, and it was absent of any language of expectation. But in my experience with Counterbalance's work, when it comes to working with women of the global majority, representation matters. I let the congregant know that I recognized her offer, but that Counterbalance does prefer to have women of the global majority with those skill sets help other women of the global majority who are seeking those skills as a matter of shared cultural, and that's where she stopped me. She said, "Say no more," her hand waving in front of her, head tilted down, visibly stopping me from saying anything else. She mentioned working with someone else who also worked the same way, and then turned around and left. That moment of cutting me off while I was trying to explain to her that the organization works a certain way for reasons of shared cultural understanding was presumptive. It was full of white fragility, and it displayed a nuance of savior complex. Savior complex being the idea that she should be able to assist the organization regardless of having a very different lived experience. The fourth microaggression I've experienced is color blindness and the blindness to differences. Quote, "I can't believe someone told you that. We UUs are so accepting," end quote. The inherent problem with saying that is thinking that acceptance of people of any background automatically means that they are above expressing ignorance, if that makes any sense. Someone can be accepting and still be willfully blinding themselves to who they are. The denial of differences denies a person's lived experience as how they identify, whether that's a person of the global majority or a person of a diverse background, or both. It is invalidating, and furthermore, it implies that it is up to you or the congregation to a greater extent to validate that person's existence. A person of the global majority doesn't get to take off their skin, and a person of a diverse background doesn't get to change who they are. So please stop ignoring these things. The last, most common microaggression I've experienced is tokenism. Quote, "As a Latinx, what do Latinxes think about this issue regarding," end quote. To assign the task of cultural representation to one person is a heavy task. It waters down the experience of so many people. And in this example that I'm going to use, I'm using the Latino perspective, which in itself is not a monolith culture. So now let's take that and apply it to the many other people of global majority and diverse backgrounds that question has been asked to in these walls. And then let's think about how their cultures aren't monoliths. Every culture is bisected over and over again by multiple intersections of existence. And yet often those questions are asked with a very broad brush. Furthermore, the answers, if given, give no incentive for the inquirer to search for deeper and more intersectional answers. Why would they? They just received an answer from a cultural representative that they designated. So these aggressions further enforce the kinds of aggressions that happen in service and in the greater institutional workings of the church. The disconnects that happen in cultural understanding make it easy to appropriate readings and music from other cultures. The othering leaves the current people of the global majority of this congregation to absence of support from those who identify with the dominant culture. Tokenism and colorblindness create a lack of equity in culturally competent programming because the illusion of inclusiveness remains both assigned to one person and a necessary in the name that we are all part of one community. So this leads me to macroaggressions. So microaggressions are the small ways in which people participate in aggression towards a marginalized group. Macroaggressions are the larger scale and overt aggressions and or overt aggressions towards marginalized groups. There is no unintentional macroaggression. Macroaggressions take conscious effort. White silence is one of the common macroaggressions that I've seen with you use. The desire not to speak up for a marginalized person because someone wants to, quote, stay in the comfort zone, end quote, is major. This recently happened at an event last month that was facilitated here, and it happens every single time we are in conversations with congregation members and we hear an inappropriate microaggression, but then say nothing. It is the act of complicity out of convenience to our comfort. Second is white avoidance. I could have easily said white privilege because it is a privilege to be able to avoid activism and visible social justice that puts you on the line. But white avoidance looks beyond privilege and into the root of why so many take advantage of the root cause of congregation members taking that privilege. At the base of it, it's avoidance of the tough issues that would force introspection of a person's reasons for not doing the work more. And that means seeing the ugly stuff. That's not to say that there won't be days where you can't make an event, but it's the difference between not being able to attend and not choosing to go. They're not the same. And conflating the two as if they are the same is willful ignorance. Third is the idea that people of the global majority and people of diverse backgrounds should want to be members of the congregation because their communities share our expressed values. So the thing is that there is no blessed community or beloved community without anti-racism work in the congregation. To think otherwise is to think that marginalized groups should be UUs is to perpetuate a servitude to whiteness and the idea of being grateful for the opportunity, in quotes, to be here. The equality of opportunity is neither approximately equal or not equal to having equitable space in the congregation. Equality of opportunity just means that we all can walk through these doors and sit down. Equitable space means we get a routine and respected say that is heard in how this congregation moves forward together. Hearing communities is paramount to the work that UUism claims to do. There's a saying my colleague and I say all the time, is your give as good as your ask? What it means is that is what you're offering to the community on par or better than what you're asking from them? UUs cannot expect a multicultural community without giving that community the respect, the understanding, the competency, and the commitment to always strive to be better that those communities have lacked from well-meaning allies for so long. If the UU community isn't giving as good as it asks, why not? What is the impediment? What are the roadblocks to creating cultural competency? Are they reasonable? If not, why not? I'm often told that fear of looking stupid is a big reason why this person or that person doesn't put themselves out more. I have a few questions to that. Were you always this perfect? Without the sarcasm, though, does it mean more to you to miss out on the vast knowledge of this world and all that its people have to offer because you let fear dictate your actions? Don't you think people of the global majority and people of diverse backgrounds also fear finding that supposedly safe space for them isn't at all meant for them? The hard truth is that people of the global majority and of diverse backgrounds don't need to be UUs. We have survived for countless generations while being shunned and made less of by other spiritual communities. But UUism does need a better relationship with people of the global majority and of diverse backgrounds, because the strength and honesty of those relationships, at a minimum, will and do dictate the credibility of the social justice work of UUism. So baselines and bridges. Why does it matter to build bridges towards diversity? Because to do anything otherwise is dishonest in claiming to work towards social justice if you are complicit in systems of oppression in big and small ways. It is downright deceptive to give anything other than your very best to build cultural competency, understanding, and equity of space. So why does it matter to build bridges towards multiculturalism? Because the world around us is multicultural. Because social justice has no impact without input of the local communities of the global majority and of diverse backgrounds. Inclusion means listening to and hearing the needs of those communities and then integrating their voices in your response. It matters because people of the global majority are the global majority. And intersectionality is a very real thing. So what does it mean to diverse communities that UUism builds bridges? What do the results of that work potentially look like? Well, if done effectively, it means honest relations with and between the communities of the Unitarian Universalist Church and of communities of the global majority and of diverse backgrounds. It manifests in actual respect for diverse communities by way of inclusivity in leadership and the willful sharing of knowledge. It means that the church's offer of, quote, a seat at the table, end quote, means true equity of space. I don't just mean physical space, but the sensory, mental, and emotional space people need to be a whole human. Equity of space is not the same as equality of opportunity. Every one of us can and did come through that door, but not all of us will leave feeling as if though our impact here is felt. Why does the church want multiculturalism and diversity? There has been a lot of talk about diversity, inclusion, and multiculturalism, but there has been little work towards doing the things that it takes to be just and inclusive. This is a baseline that needs deep reflection. What does the church gain from having a congregation that is more multicultural and diverse that doesn't sound steeped in tokenism? Commitment and community. So what can be done in commitment to lead to community? There must be self-accountability. Recently, the change team was conducting surveys to get a feel for the anti-racism work that needs to be done in the congregation. It was my turn to table, and a congregant asked what the surveys were about. I told her, and her reaction was, "Well, I know I have discrimination, so I don't think I could do that." I said to her, "That's all the more reason to do the survey. The change team is here to try and help do the work as a congregation, so we recognize that this is a community effort." She continued to refuse. Then she stated that it's okay because the younger generations will take over and do better. I was disheartened. She had removed herself from the hard work because she didn't see that this was all our work. This will be continuous work too. And if you think that you will ever be done with the work of holding yourself accountable for your actions and your impact towards others, then you're only fooling yourself. Being self-accountable means reviewing your discriminations, doing the work of addressing those discriminations, reviewing them again, and then doing more work. So hint, the cycle never ends. That doesn't make it any less worth doing. UUs also need to be accountable to the work the church asks of them. People of the global majority owe UUism nothing. People of diverse backgrounds owe UUism nothing. What you give should be a gift without expectations. If you expect the global majority and diverse people to show up because you are charitable and you claim to be welcoming, then you're not adhering to the first, the second, and the seventh principles of UUism. The first principle affirms and promotes the inherent worth and dignity of every person. When you hold an expectation for a marginalized group to be a part of your congregation because you claim minimum standards such as being welcoming, you are ignoring the dignity and worth that that group holds for itself to expect more than the minimum. The second principle affirms and promotes justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. It is neither just nor equitable nor compassionate to expect that a marginalized community be here because you give to their communities. The seventh principle affirms and promotes respect for the interdependent web of all existence for which we are a part. It is not respectful of the interdependent web of all existence to use other cultures' readings and songs without showing respect for their origins and their histories. It's not respectful to the interdependent web to claim the work of social justice and then not actually show up for the work. It's not respectful to claim respect for the interdependent web of all existence and turn a blind eye to the needs of those whose parts of the web is an entirely different experience than your own. So show up, speak up, and give without expectation. Give because nowhere in the principles that guide UUism does it say that you should expect anything in return. Hold others to accountability. Speak up always. To the microaggressions and the macroaggressions, speak up. Create and hold space for those of us of the global majority and diverse backgrounds that are already here in the congregation. On Sunday, April 22nd, there will be a Spring Into Action workshop, living out the eighth principle of UU at our church. It's going to be in room 13 from 12:30 to 2 p.m. Leaders from both White Allies for Racial Equity and the First UU People of Color Group will give a workshop on how we can more fully live out the eighth principle by helping us reflect on how some of our well-intentioned words and behaviors have unintended consequences for POC, and how changing that behavior will help us more fully realize our goal of beloved community. Hold that space. Challenge what the norm is in UUism. If you see a lack of programming, if you see a lack of space, if there is a voice absent in a room that needs that voice, just challenge the norm. Just because it has been doesn't mean we have to continue allowing it to be. Raise the expectations for the congregation, not for the people of the global majority and people of diverse backgrounds. That goes hand in hand with challenging the norm. Nothing will change if UUs don't change the system. I know that this has been a rough forum, and I hope that some of this makes sense. And I want to remind people that I'm still here for a good reason. I feel a connection with this community that I have been lacking in my life for a long time. And I'm asking, as a person of the global majority, to raise the standard because we need it. And if it doesn't make sense right away, I hope you'll sit with these words some more to help them make sense. Because this isn't sustainable. Asking people of the global majority and of diverse backgrounds to come to our open arms when we can feel the thorns of silence and complicity pushing into us, that's a hard ask. So give. Give freely. Give generously. Give the things that are intangible, because those are the things no one can take back without shame.
You're listening to People United, the show in solidarity with the people of the world. I'm Alan Campbell. This hour, People United is featuring Maria Milner on diversity, outreach, and internal work, particularly as they pertain to relations between Unitarian Universalist congregations and people of color. Her focus often also extends to people of other marginalized groups and the intersection thereof. Moreover, listeners may find her insights applicable to other institutions, secular as well as religious. Maria Milner is a Latinx cultural consultant, a co-founder of the social action group Voces Tejas, and a member of the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin. She spoke at her church on April 15th, 2018. At this point, we hear her answer questions from those in attendance. Luther Elmore of the church's Public Affairs Forum called on audience members. We return now to Maria Milner. You're listening to People United on KOOP, Co-op Radio, Austin.
And now I hope some of you have some questions, some points of discussion to ask of her. And as I come to you, please state your name and ask your question. First question from Scott Butke.
Thanks for coming and giving your perspective. I wanted to hear what you thought about the eighth principle idea and how that fits in with what you're talking about.
The eighth principle of UUism is like very directly attacking or addressing racism as it applies to the UU church. So it is the cornerstone of the kind of work that we need to be doing at this point. It is the basis, the principle that we need to be using as a guiding light, whether it's a small candle or a lighthouse. We need to be using that to continue the work forward. When we're in doubt, we need to be using the eighth principle as a way to reconnect with our intentions as UUs and in our community and also in the community at large.
Hi, Richard Halpin is my name. And from your experience here at the church and being a member of this beloved community, what ways are we making progress, and what specific ways do you see that we can do better?
I think inviting people like me who are willing to challenge, and you all sitting here and listening to that challenge and digesting that information, is crucial work. So I greatly thank you all that are here and listening to this, because that is part of the work. You have to educate yourself in order to really reflect on how that applies to you and then turn around and work on that externally. So there's that. In terms of the work that needs to get done, like I said, supporting our local community of the global majority, getting to know our local people of the global majority in ways that they are comfortable, in ways that don't violate either their space or their culture, their diversity. And it's not just a multiracial stance. We have people with disabilities who attend First UU, and they are diverse backgrounds. They're people who don't experience life in a way that a good majority of the population does. You know, getting to know each other as a congregation, as a community. We have a lot of internal work that we need to do before we can even start looking at building the beloved community outside of the walls of the church. So let's start there.
Speaking of those issues outside of the church, how would you respond to the current national and international climate in which not only in this state, in this country, but we also have a backlash against immigrants and people of color in Western Europe? I mean, it just seems to be that we're moving further and further away from any kind of universal understanding of people. How would you respond to what's happening internationally?
My initial response is that it greatly affects me. I know that it greatly affects a lot of people that I know personally. It affects people that you don't expect also. We think of immigrants and the immigrant community in the United States as being predominantly Latino, but there are a lot of African immigrants that are being targeted. This year alone, only 11 refugees from Syria were let into the United States. So it's not a particular culture's problem. It is not a particular ethnic group's problem. We are, as a country, suffering from a lack of being in touch with who we want to be very honest. And so we have to ask ourselves those questions. Who do we want to be, and how do we hold ourselves accountable to reaching that? And it starts with internal work that a person has to do. And it's hard work. It is not easy at all. But it all just comes down to how much you think something is worth it. And if this community, if this society is worth saving or building in a positive direction, then the work needs to get done. So it's difficult and it's heartbreaking, but I guess I have hope. My people have been surviving for a while, so.
Could you illustrate in more depth what you mean by intersectionality?
Intersectionality is kind of like taking different aspects of a person and then crossing them with how they are as a person. So I'll take myself for example. I identify as a woman of color, particularly I am Latina of Mexican descent. I am a woman. I have, you know, family obligations. My class also is a part of that intersectionality where I fall in class, how I view myself and how I actually exist in the outside world. My health conditions, all of those things will dictate intersectionality. So if you have, for example, an immigrant person who happens to be a woman who is Latina, who is of mixed status or undetermined status, who has a disability, and who is impoverished, all of those things are going to intersect with who that person is and how they perceive the world around them. And so this idea that we work on a baseline of everybody has the same opportunity as I do is completely inaccurate. And it hinders us as a society. It hinders us to understanding how we can do more within the community. Because if we all think that the community is doing just as well as we are, we're not inclined to do more. So intersectionality really breaks that down into an idea of what does it mean to be that person? What does it mean to be an impoverished person who has recently become a citizen? Or what does it mean to be middle class and yet still struggling paycheck to paycheck and be a person that who identifies as white and culturally identifies as previous heritage as something else? So that's intersectionality. It's being able to take a person's parts and seeing how it makes them whole.
Hi, I'm Tomas Medina, and thank you very much for speaking so eloquently about what so many of us who are people of color here at First UU feel. My question is about the showing up. I wonder if you can elaborate a little bit on that.
Sure. The kind of work that we do here at the UU Church, the things that we advertise, if we're advertising programming where people of color or White Allies for Racial Equity is hosting an event, showing up. Like literally just showing up and getting through the door and having that conversation and listening and, you know, not necessarily talking, but just listening. you know, posting things like marches. I know that Alphabet Soup Group last year had a table out at Austin Pride. And so showing, you know, having members who are willing to show up to that and talk about UUism and talk about UUism as it relates to their Alphabet Soup Group, that's showing up to support that particular marginalized community in ways that are more impactful than just saying, I really support having an Alphabet Soup Group at the church. That's great. You could support a lot of things, but showing support means so much more. And so that's showing up, just being there.
Would you stretch your description and talk about showing up in more specific examples, how you think we can show up here as a community and be more of the people we all want to be?
Sure. It, I guess, kind of does require a little bit of more uncomfort or discomfort. But for example, Service Saturday was yesterday, and it was the Keep Austin Beautiful event. Service Saturday is a program from UU Social Action here at the church, and we struggled to get people to attend. I'm still not sure what the final numbers are, but I don't anticipate that we're very good. But we offer opportunities to do social action within the church, and people don't sign up. People aren't coming out, but specifically coming out to events that the church is hosting, that church groups are hosting to build community, to question, to challenge, push the boundaries of what you think and feel, that is the first step, I would say. I think maybe if people want to go a little bit broader, if there are people who know of marches that happen around Austin, and making it a regular thing to kind of attend or make sure that we know this information. But I would definitely say starting at home first is a good way to go about doing something very specific.
So a specific example would be the benefit concert we're having Friday night.
Yes, yes, that would be. Yes.
For the Austin Sanctuary Network, Friday night at 7 o'clock at the St. Andrews Presbyterian Church.
Yes.
With singer Carrie Newcomer.
Yes, and knowing that Austin Sanctuary Network is a sanctuary network that helps to protect our immigrant community in Austin in ways that seem hopeless to them at the time. It is right here at home. Learning about it and learning about all of the other groups is a way to start, and then to be able to ask the question, when do you meet? What can I support? How can I volunteer to help your event be a success? Who can I bring? How can I talk to people about what you're doing? And going on and just going from there, but offering, again, giving generously of yourself with no expectation.
This reminds me of a conversation I had this past week that from your comments today that I was speaking to someone who had visited a UU church in San Antonio. And much like us, that church is hugely predominantly white, although San Antonio, I think, is 60 or 70% Hispanic. And so, based on what you're saying, what brought you initially here? You know, what piqued you to want to come and see what we're about so that possibly we can extend that to others?
I came to First UU for VDR training. So it was completely not along the lines of anything church-related or spiritually related. I came here with a very singular purpose. And I was waiting before the VDR training started, and I started looking at the walls in Houston Hall. And I read the mission, which is up here, and it says, "We gather in community to nourish souls, transform lives, and do justice." And it was a very difficult time in my life. It was last year, March, and things just felt like they were falling apart. I didn't believe that people wanted to do justice anymore because of the condition of our society. So the idea of a place that was doing justice seemed kind of crazy to me, and I wanted to be a part of that insanity. But, you know, and having been here, we do a lot of work towards justice, but a lot of our groups seem to be working very alone. We have these islands that are just one group over here and another group over there, and we need to find a better way to congeal. And we definitely need to find the community, the internal community, to become activated in the kind of work that we do. And I think to the ultimate point that you were saying about attracting people from the outside, We just can't right now. I think we need to work on the internal community more than anything. To put it in UU terms, if we can brighten our shine and make our light larger, then like a lighthouse will bring people. But we have to go from this candle that we are to a lighthouse.
Hi, my name's Andy Gerhart, and I'm a seminarian hoping to be a UU minister here in Austin. I'm finding that a huge hollow, vacuous part of my education is exactly what you presented on. What other resources outside of the UU in our community do you recommend?
Like, in our...
educationally, just like this.
The best education you can possibly get is supporting local organizations. The education that you will get, the crash course in cultural competency, in local issues, in issues of race, class, gender, the whole nine yards, ableism, cisgender identity, heterosexual versus homosexuality, like all of that you can get by being a part of the communities that you're in individually without the expectation that it's going to feed into your education as a UU. But what you do end up finding out is that you start looking at UUism with a completely different lens. And you look at things and think of, what if we did this differently? Or, what if this group knew about this opportunity? Or what if this organization knew about us? You know, and yeah, that does a lot of the internal work. I would highly recommend reaching out to local organizations of all kinds and then just kind of getting a sampling of everything and seeing how they discuss things, how they discuss each other, their communities, the communities around them, what relationships are strong within each group and which ones, seem like they might need a little bit more work, and then think about how that is in relation to where you are. That's the best education.
Thank you so much for being here and for challenging us to do better. One of the things you're challenging us to do is our own internal work. And so I wanted to put in a plug for White Allies, because that's what we're doing in White Allies. And it's usually kind of the same group of people that show up. And so it would be really wonderful for other people who are interested in doing our internal work to show up. And actually, Scott Butke and I are co-leaders for that. And our next meeting that we have after Spring Into Action, we're going to be talking about the microaggressions that Maria has been talking about, really trying to look into when and where they happen with us and try to figure out how to do better.
Do you have any comments on your work with White Allies or how they're interfacing with that?
I think I have the good fortune of having some really good friends in White Allies for Racial Equity. And just based on their personhood, I have a lot of confidence that our White Allies for Racial Equity group can lead people through a lot of the heavy discussions that they might need to face and challenge, and in ways that are understanding but firm. And that is an incredible combination to have. You don't normally get someone who is kind and compassionate, but also very much willing to hold you to task. It's a delicate balance, and I think that the people that I know that are part of White Allies for Racial Equity do that very well.
When I think about intersectionality about myself, I actually realize that not only like are there disadvantages, just being a woman, but also like my ancestors also took from other people. And when I think about myself and how my culture was shaped and how my culture shaped other people to benefit off them, I was wondering if you could talk about that.
Sure. Actually, that is something that, especially lately, I've been thinking a lot about. As somebody who identifies as Mexican descent, you have to put this in maybe heavy terms for the audience, you have to kind of deal with the colonizer and the colonized, and those two identities in one person. I can't ignore that there is Spanish influence in who I am, whether it's because it's in my bloodline or it's in my culture as someone who identifies as Mexican, it's there. It's hard to deal with those conflicts, but give yourself that time to mourn and give yourself the allowance to grieve and be in pain for the things that you still couldn't control because of where you are now. It's very human and maybe not human, but it's understandable because of that conflict, the conflict of identities. And the best thing that you can do is to take what you know of both sides and do the best from both. And that makes forgiveness a lot easier, because then you know that you have the chance to do things completely different than your ancestry, that you are not beholden to your bloodline or your one side of a culture versus another. You are in complete control of where you focus your energy. And, you know, it's going to be hard. You're going to have days where you're going to want to focus all that energy into the negative aspect. But forgive yourself. It's okay to have those days. If you can shoot for better days more often than bad days, you're doing okay.
Hi, Lisa Brown. Maria, you spoke recently about from the ally perspective toward collaborator, and I thought that might be helpful to this forum as well,
yeah,
if you don't mind.
Yes, so Lisa is referring to a talk that I gave to the Women's Alliance this past Tuesday, and at one point I discussed the difference between allyship and collaboratorship. I believe it was during question and answer as well. And I guess I should state my standpoint. I don't believe in allies. I believe in collaborators. Allyship is really easy to take off. You can step back. It is the thing that reinforces white avoidance. It's a way of saying, I'm going to do this much, and then I'm going to give myself a gold star about doing it, and then we're just going to kind of move on. But collaboratorship requires investment, and not just financial investment, the investment of time, of emotion, of energy, of all kinds of effort that make us who we are. And so I like to graduate allies to collaborators. The moment somebody says to me, oh, how can I do more? And I didn't see something this way. Thank you for letting me know. Where can I learn more to it? I'm secretly graduated you. You are on your way. But it is important. It is important to take that step to make it as much as macroaggressions are a conscious effort. The way to change that is also a conscious effort. Macro and microaggressions, the idea that you're talking to somebody and you're so tempted to ask, like, where are you from? Because it's such a knee-jerk reaction and, you know, they're exotic or they're different. And controlling yourself and just asking questions that, you know, hey, what did you do today? I went to the grocery store. Oh, what did you buy? Like, really boring, run-of-the-mill questions, because it's, you know, what? Why not? Why not? Why not treat a person like they're a person? Why not treat a person like they do at things like everybody else? So graduating allies to collaborators, I'm super for that. I am definitely more pro that. But allyship is easy. Like I said earlier, I don't get a chance to, and a lot of the people that I know, they don't get to take off their skin or change who they are. And that's basically what collaboratorship is, making a conscious decision that you are going to put this effort to do more, to be more, and you're going to make mistakes, and that's okay. Just like I was saying to the young lady in the back there, you got to forgive yourself, but you got to keep moving, because this world isn't going to stop spinning because you decided that things got hard. They didn't stop for any of my ancestors. They won't stop now.
You mentioned about hymns being used without cultural context. How would you see that working? Or are you suggesting we just get rid of those hymns? Or are you saying before we sing it, we need to talk about the origination of it?
Actually, I think it would be a really good idea if we can't talk about that in service, like just a brief one-liner or something, putting it in the order of service, just addressing like these hymns and these readings come from, like having a page that says, you know, this is where these readings are coming from, this is the origin of them, and this is how we're using them. Because I think sometimes also with UUism and different UU churches and services, you get some pretty like stretches about using a hymn for a particular, you know, has something to do with water, even though the song might be layered in meaning for a particular culture. It's like, oh, it's about water, so let's use it because we're talking about water today. It's not the same thing. I think having that, just having that opportunity for people to be able to read that at some point. I mean, if we have these orders of service, let's use them for a little education beyond what we're doing.
Sharnaz Garcia. Maria, thank you so much. I have a question sort of embedded in a comment. So often when this hard work that you're talking about doing happens in inter-ethnic settings with people of color doing the work together with white people, in my experience and from what I've heard and what I've seen you here today as well, a lot of learning for white people happens when people of color have to bear their heart and soul and share their stories of pain. And that just doesn't necessarily resonate with me as the way that I would want to engage in this work. So as we talk about doing this work in First UU, what's your sense of how we, people of the global majority, could collaborate with others who are white predominantly here to do that?
Yes, and I think it also bears to say people who identify with the dominant culture as a whole. when I'm not willing to talk about things, I refer people, I actually use the phrase, Google that. It's what it's there for. It's a resource to learn and educate more. And I tell people, I'm not expecting you to learn everything or get a PhD from using Google, but the question that you're asking me is certainly available online. If internet is not your thing, which I get because I'm on my computer all the time and the last thing I want to be is on it more, there are plenty of books. What we can do is offer a book list that people can refer to and just be like, kind of like a syllabus. A long time ago in a previous life, I helped students as an IA, and I always used the phrase, look at the syllabus. Look at the syllabus. You don't have to ask me this question because it's in the syllabus. And so I think that a way for our community to maybe put ourselves on one more time, just one more time, is to put a syllabus up and say, hey, this is your reading list. These are a glossary of terms, and I need you to do your homework before you approach me.
Maria, in conclusion, could you give us a brief statement or overview of what you want us to take away today?
Sure. I want to stress again that I believe that this community can do good for everybody, people in this community, outside of this community. I think that what the mission that we stand for here, especially here at First UU, has value. But I think we have a lot of internal work to do. And I think that if we can do that work, we are capable of extreme greatness in terms of just how much good we can do in the world. But we also have to do that without expectation. We have to measure our give and see if it's as good as our ask before we can even start building the beloved community outside of the church. Because we have a beloved community here, and it needs some love.
Maria Milner, thank you very much.
You've been listening to People United, the show in solidarity with the people of the world. This week, People United featured Maria Milner on diversity, outreach, and internal work, particularly as they pertain to relations between Unitarian Universalist congregations and people of color. Maria Milner is a Latinx cultural consultant, a co-founder of the social action group Voces Tejas, and a member of the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin. She spoke at her church on April 15th, 2018. Luther Elmore of the church's Public Affairs Forum moderated questions and answers. I'm Alan Campbell, and you've been listening to People United on KOOP. Cooperatio Austin.